Hello, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness podcast. This is a podcast for people who want to have more great conversations in your life. You want to connect, you want to speak authentically, and you want to listen deeply. This is how to do it, and it's the real deal. So why should you listen to the Language of Mindfulness? Because in every episode, I'm going to give you tips and guidance I've learned in my pretty extensive career of coaching and practice from the best and brightest in the field of interpersonal communications, public speaking, meditation, group leadership, and somatic psychology. And we're going to have interviews with some amazing people about their groundbreaking work. It's my goal to give actionable and uncommon tips and advice in every episode that you can implement right away. So subscribe or follow now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you don't listen, you're going to miss some great stuff that you just won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Brett Hill, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness. Hey there, this is Brett Hill with Language of Mindfulness, and I wanted to talk a little bit today about a really difficult topic, and it's how to talk to someone who is kind of entrenched in their beliefs in a way that you can, well, let me just say, it'd be better to avoid things that aren't going to work. Like if you really want to have a conversation with someone and you have an objective difference of opinion or point of view or belief, these are the kinds of things that can be very difficult. They can split families and relationships and careers, or conversely, they can, the differences when they dissolve in a way or get resolved can facilitate those same things. It depends. It's all very situational, right? But what we know doesn't work is, you know, two people whose point of view isn't likely to be changed kind of regardless of what another person says. And that kind of is part of the clue, right? So here's an interesting question. It's like, take a strongly held belief that you have and ask yourself the question, what would you have to learn? What fact would you have to know to change that belief? Now, in some cases, you know, beliefs are objective and more objective in nature, in the sense that they're not, you might not say they're actually beliefs, but they're kind of your best conclusions about some process or fact. Like, I really believe that if we manufacture the beer this way, it's going to be better. And maybe there's some tests and measurements that you've done. And so a new fact that comes along about some kind of new yeast or some kind of new process might change your point of view because there's kind of an objective measure. But let's just take that same situation and say that you were devoted to some long process that I'm sure, I know virtually nothing about brewing beer. I just kind of happened to pick it out of the air. But let's just say that there's some long fermentation process that is, named after some, famous beermeister who created a legendary brew and has devotees. And so the person brewing the beer might think, I'm that kind of, I do that kind of brewing. That's the name, and I'm associated. Let's just give it a name out of the air. Let's call it Long Haul Brew. And so I'm a Long Haul Brewer. And so somebody comes up with some information and says, there's this new process. And goes, oh, no, that just can't work because, there's this big history and there's all this experience behind this other process. And so there's just no way that this new thing could actually be equivalent or better. Now, we don't know if the new thing is equivalent or better, but we do know is if you listen to the language that's involved with the objection, it's not about, well, what is this new process and let's find out. It's more about, how does this person identify? It's like, rather than just, here's what I believe about brewing, it's, I am that kind of a brewer. Do you understand the difference? It's like, one is identity. That's who I am. It's not just, I want to do the best that I can. It's, I am that kind of a brewer. So if you present someone with facts that challenge whether or not that is a good approach, is the best idea or not, or even a good idea in some ways, it's not that you've challenged an objective situation. It's that you've challenged their actual identity. Suddenly, it's not how do we make good beer, but it's like you're assaulting their very character, because you're asserting in a way that, well, the thing that I've actually hung my identity around is not that valuable after all. And that's the trick, you see. So this has to do with how do people identify with positions or beliefs. So let's just say here's one that rings a lot of bells, and that's that, I'm a capitalist, or I'm a socialist, or I'm this kind of believe in this kind of an economy, a communist, or whatever it is you happen to believe. The point of view is that rather than saying, I believe that that's the best type of economy, it's like, I am that. I am a capitalist. That's who I am. That's part of my nature. So if you're a hardcore capitalist and you believe in, like, profits above all else, and then you get presented with some information that, hey, maybe we ought to kind of socialize the benefits a little bit, and you go, no, because that interferes with, private enterprise and, free enterprise. And it's not just an idea. It's not just say, hey, let's figure out what's the best approach. It's more of an identity. It's like, well, that's who I am. I am that. I'm a capitalist. And that gets bundled up with these values clusters. Like, not only am I a capitalist, but I'm an American, and I believe in individuality. And there's this whole values cluster that comes along with these things, so that you can't really even talk about, well, what's really best, without challenging someone's beliefs about themselves. And when you're dealing with someone like that, and this goes for me and everybody else in the world too, I mean, like, I believe I am a mindful guy. I believe in mindfulness, and I have adopted that. It's a big part of my lifestyle, my life. And so when someone says, well, I don't know about mindfulness, it's kind of like, whoa, you're really challenging something I'm putting a lot of value in myself. And I have to take a breath and go, okay, what's really being said here? What's really true? And that's the bottom line, isn't it? It's like, if you're what I consider to be, the way I evaluate these kinds of things is I sit back and I go, well, what would you wish for in a healthy human being? And what I would wish for in anyone is the flexibility and capacity to make the best decision possible given the information that we have, the freedom, or sometimes I call this the range, to have the range that's necessary to be able to say, well, I used to do it this way, but now I'm going to try it this other way because it seems like it might be better. Rather than, well, I'm a that way kind of guy. I always go north. I never go east or west because north is the best way to go. So don't even tell me that the east is, there's a better way, because I'm a north guy. And so when you say it in those kinds of terms, it doesn't make any sense. But it's so true that we encounter this kind of identification with positions and beliefs all the time. Now, when you encounter someone like that, let's just say you happen to be in a situation where someone is a little more identified than you are, or you've got enough mindfulness going on where you're going, oh, I recognize the problem here. And the problem is, I can't really even talk about this because to do so really challenges who they are. What do you do when you notice that? Well, first of all, you have to be sure that you've got a read on yourself to take a breath, and check in with what's this conversation like, and how much do you want to invest in trying to put a different point of view out. In some of these situations, it may be best to kind of not really pull that string, you know what I mean? Because you're really going to have a challenging time. Now, if you are going to do that, there's been some really good advice given along the way by quite a few people, one of them being Benjamin Franklin, and strangely enough, he talked about a process that he uses whenever he was dealing with people in politics and of course, where do you find more entrenched positions than there? And he said the technique would be something along the lines of, first, to acknowledge that the point of view that the person is talking about makes sense. Okay, now this can be challenging whenever you really feel like it doesn't. And so how can you do this with some integrity, right? So the way he would do it, he would say something along the lines of, I understand my esteemed colleague's point of view, and it makes a lot of sense given the circumstances that from his point of view, or with a limited set of information is what you really want to say. You want to say, well, given this narrow set of understandings, that makes perfect sense. So you can say, well, I can see how from your point of view that might make sense. And the important thing, the reason you do that kind of thing, and this is very big in other cultures, is you want to give people the opportunity to save face, right? Because we're dealing with a situation where people are identified. It's a personal integrity matter, not a factual matter. If you go after the personal integrity, if you don't address that issue of personal integrity, you're not going to get very far. Because the next thing you're going to say is, what my esteemed colleague may not realize is that there's new information about XYZ that, and while it's perfectly understandable, this previous position, now we have a new possibility which is worthy of consideration. And so consequently, I would suggest that we engage in a conversation about what this might mean. And in this way, you can help a situation be less seen as a personal attack, even though that's not what you're doing. You're still defusing you're trying to address the situations from a point of view of, oh, I see that this is going to be received in a reactive, defensive way. What can I do that feels like I have in personal integrity that doesn't, that gives this thing a chance? Now, that's no guarantee that this is going to work at all. But it takes those kinds of considerations to kind of get under the wire, the tripwire of personal reactivity. And so you can kind of keep coming with these kinds of messages to help to differentiate between the personal identification and the facts at hand. And while you can't control what other people do, and you can adjust your messaging to give your point of view its best shot at being heard. Now, given the state of polarization and reactivity and anxiety in the culture today, it's not so likely that this is going to work if you have somebody who's kind of decoupled from objective considerations. And we have a lot of that going on. We have a lot of people in the world who it doesn't really matter what the facts are. It's more important, like, the source of the facts. So if this came from this news thing or this came from this political party, then it doesn't matter if it's true or not. We're going to reject it, even if it's a good idea. And so that's where you get into trouble, and you wind up in the end being entrenched into what could be very dysfunctional positions in order to preserve an integrated sense of identity that's just gotten so divorced from, you know, the aspects of grounded in our experience facts that they don't even resemble sustainable points of view. How do we live in the world? Well, you know, there are some eccentric circles with lots of people in them these days that advocate for positions that aren't very sustainable for themselves or for multitudes on the planet. And that can be kind of dangerous. And so it's important that we learn to think about how we can have conversations that are possible to be had. And I want to make it clear, some of these conversations just can't be had because there's kind of no one home, and those people on automatic, you're not going to be able to connect with those people on these kinds of differentiating or polarizing issues and make any headway. The best way to move that is on a personal level. Let me give you an example from the book Difficult Conversations. I interviewed Kern Berry, who wrote this book, and it was a great book, and he talks about in that book a guy who was a black man who was who went to these KKK meetings in, I believe it was Georgia, and befriended the Grand Wizard. And it's like, wait, what? And the guy wasn't trying to convince the Grand Wizard of anything. He was just going, and they struck up a conversation, and he just didn't, you know, he didn't, of course, agree with what was going on, but he didn't try to humiliate the guy or, you know, overtly diminish him, even though that may have been called for in certain situations. But over like a year or two, he actually began, this Grand Wizard began to actually unwind from his beliefs about black people, and eventually hung up his robe, saying, you know, I was wrong. But it took the personal connection and consistent interaction in order to make that happen. Another example along those lines, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of this, but I'm just recalling it as I'm speaking, is a gentleman who used to be a very rabid anti-gay advocate. And he was on the speaking circuit for such things and, you know, rallying people against anti-gay beliefs and anti-gay practices and policies, and saying, you know, this is not something that should be happening in the world, and it's unethical, and it's a danger, and blah, 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 the whole, you know, line that goes along with it. And so his identity, as you can see here, is like, I am someone who does not believe in this behavior. And then again, there's a whole identity cluster that goes along with that. And over the years, he began to soften it. And when asked why, he said that the gay community, LGBT community, was coming out to his events, and they would come out and they would talk to him afterwards. And he said he, over the period of a year or two, began to realize that all the things that he was saying about who these people were, it wasn't true, that they were actually, you know, reasonable in quotes, right, for him, people, that they were just regular, ordinary folk that were actually likable and could be friends, and they're not a threat to you or anyone else in the world. And so he began to relax his stance around this, because it was his direct experience was in contradiction to his beliefs. And that's the kind of thing that can unwind someone from, you know, these tightly held beliefs, is because very often they are ideas. They're just concepts about who I am, someone who believes these things. And these things are very often just ideas. They're not rooted in your actual experience. And so when you start to have a life experience that is in conflict with your beliefs, eventually that direct experience will win, because a part of our nervous system is such that you have to make sense of your experience. If you encounter some dramatic experience in your life that is really in contrast to what you believe is true, your brain is going to have a really hard time incorporating that information. And you'll see this over and over again. Oh, I used to believe X until this thing happened, you know, and we all have stories of those sorts. And they can be pretty life-changing stories whenever you encounter an experience or a set of experiences that runs contradictory to your belief system. And that's how people wind up changing religions or relationships or countries, even. Political parties. And so consequently, those are the kinds of things that matter, are the direct experience that someone has in their life. And can you be a facilitator? Like if you encounter someone who believes that, you know, if you're a liberal and someone, you encounter someone who's more of a conservative, and they believe all liberals believe in big government, and they just want, you know, open borders and the whole cluster of talking points that come out about it. And they meet you, and you don't necessarily believe in those things, but you believe in what I consider to be this is my identity, a rational belief system around what is the best, what makes sense. Maybe open borders are best, maybe they're not. Maybe closed borders are best at times. It's not about, it's got to be one way all the time. It could be that things change. There's a big influx of people, overwhelming systems. Well, maybe we need to talk about some kind of humane, organized system that allows us to throttle intake simply because we need to protect our institutions from being overburdened. It's as simple as that. It's not a statement about is immigration good or bad. It's about volume. What can we actually manage? At least that's the way maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's the way I think about it. I think about, well, let's do what makes sense rather than have a belief about the right thing and it's always the right thing. Just because of it. It's sort of like the same argument I hear a lot about people who are skeptics who say, well, I'm a skeptic, or there's nothing wrong with being skeptical. And my response to that is, well, yeah, there is sometimes. And it's not when you are a skeptic for the sake of being a skeptic, then that's a bias, just as biased as any other bias. And the question isn't, is it good or bad to be skeptical? The question is, when does it make sense to be skeptical? I'm not going to be skeptical about, is the sun hot? You know, this just doesn't make it, that's a pointless point. I'm not going to, but if I'm valuing, well, let me argue that because I'm a skeptic, and so consequently, hot compared to what? Hot compared to how hot can be, or, you know, hot compared to something, you know, you can always make a finessed point that's ridiculous, but keeps you from having to agree. And if you're a skeptic, then that's particularly the value that you're after. And so I say, let's just chill around all that and do what makes the most sense. And that means having, as someone once said, having strong beliefs loosely held, so that you're willing to examine, am I right? Is it okay if I'm not right? That's another thing. It's like you meet people who are like, man, they have to be right. It really matters to them. And so you just relax around that, and for yourself, so that you can engage in a process of continuous inquiry about what is necessary. So that's the thing I like to say. It's like, what's necessary? Let's do what's needed. And so let's have the conversation that's needed. In order to do that, we have to be pretty mindful of what's going on within ourselves and also how people work, what goes on the other side of a conversation. And so you take a breath and you recognize that we're all human beings. We all are. Live on the same planet, we breathe the same air, and we have the same hopes and dreams and ambitions in a lot of ways. And while those might vary in detail, underneath it all, we want to be healthy, we want to have a good day, we want to like the people that we like, and, you know, feel good about our lives. And the beliefs that we have that are very different often just get in the way of these basic facts. And if we can keep that point of view in mind, then maybe we have a chance to find a way to have a conversation about what makes sense that isn't about, I'm going to diminish you with a different belief. My beliefs are a threat to you. And you know, in some cases, someone's beliefs may be an actual physical threat. If you have a belief that some race is inferior or some other race is superior, and you're not a member of that race, then that can be a threat. And so those kinds of things have to be acknowledged and dealt with, and as well in a real way. And with those people, you aren't likely necessarily to find common ground. But yet, even as I've given an example, when you connect person to person, lots of things can shift. So maybe that's a possibility. Maybe that's something you can look to as a possibility in your life, to connect person to person when it's feasible, and also to model that for other people as well. So I could go on a long time about this, but in summarizing, effectively, people get really attached to their ideas about who they are. You know, well, I'm a mystic, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, I'm a this, I'm a that. And so check that language in yourself. Notice the things that you identify as you. I am that, I am this. And see if there's something in you that is underneath all of that that can recognize that really you are none of those things. You're something significantly more powerful, if you will, more foundational than the things that have happened to you or the beliefs that you hold. Those are beliefs and those are simply events that have occurred in your life. Oh, I'm someone who is unlucky. I'm someone who's lucky. Oh, it never works out for me. And those are the kinds of stories that reflect the attachment of your experiences to your identity. So notice those kinds of thoughts and take a breath and go, oh, I'm going to reframe that and say, I'm someone who has experienced a lot of things not working out for me. And that's how you begin to reframe your sense of who you are to be something bigger than the things that have happened to you. Because most people are not so separated from that. And that's not a judgment. That's a neurological, there's a lot of neurological stickiness there. It takes a practice, and that's why the mindfulness is so powerful. So take a breath and notice, oh, I'm having the thought that I am an unlucky person, or I'm a lucky person. And maybe I could, what happens? What does it feel like when I say, I'm someone who has had a lot of unfortunate things. I'm someone who has had some rough breakups. I'm someone who has enjoyed some lucky coincidences in life. That doesn't make me lucky. It just means I have experienced these things. And I'm not trying to be pedantic. Is there such a thing as luck or not? I'm just trying to say it's about identity. And if you manage to effectively do that, there can come into your awareness this experience of a self, an experience that's kind of label-free, that doesn't have a voice about what it is or a judgment about the quality of your moment. Because what you are is simply this emerging presence of now. Being in that experience is a fairly profound way to walk through a moment. And I would invite you to give it a whirl because it can rock your world. How do you begin? Just a straight up mindfulness meditation is a great way to start. I have a blueprint for mindfulness meditation on my website at languageofmindfulness.com/now. And there you can begin this very simple, direct, watching your breath, taking a moment to just notice your thoughts, notice your feelings, notice your experience, name those things, come back to your breath. 2 seconds later, you're off in a daydream. Oh, wait, I'm off in a daydream. Having the noticing, oh, I'm off in a daydream. Coming back to your experience, your breath. And just rinse and repeat, because by doing that, you create neurological muscle, if you will, to bring your attention back to your experience. And that's the way home. That's the way you create spaciousness in your moment that gives you the opportunity to be present when other people are feeling resistant, attached, to notice, oh, they're feeling resistant and attached. Well, how do I want to be in conversation with someone who's feeling resistant and attached and maybe attacked? Rather than you being defensive or aggressive or backing up, you get to make a choice. And that's really what it's all about. the opportunity to choose. And hopefully you can develop some skills around that as well. And that when you have all this kind of wired up, then you're beginning to speak the language of mindfulness. Thank you. So that's a wrap on today's edition of the Language of Mindfulness podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. If so, please leave us a review on iTunes and follow along on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. We'd really appreciate it. And check us out at languageofmindfulness.com, where you can sign up for a free coaching session or download our PDF on 8 ways to be more mindful in a virtual meeting at languageofmindfulness.com/8, number 8, ways. Thanks a ton, and we're looking forward to a lot of great new content coming up as well. Have a great one and stay present. Thanks.